fact, soon introduce us. You can probably imagine Bert's setup. Huge, luxurious office on 57th Street, in a neighborhood where wealthy New Yorkers shopped at places like Bergdorf Goodman and FAO Schwartz. Padel had an enormous walnut desk surrounded by gold records on the walls and extensive memorabilia, all signed by the biggest achievers in their fields.
I remember seeing a big autographed picture of Babe Ruth. Just wanted you to know.
He enjoyed handing guests copies of a Vanity Press published book of poems he'd written called Bert's Words. The reality of Russell Simmons' office at that time was different. We're talking two small rooms. In the front sat longtime Rush staffer Heidi Smith and longtime Rush publicist Bill Adler. Heidi seemed like she'd been around since day one. She was the office grown-up, a straight-laced, make-it-happen woman. Bill was a bearded white guy who seemed run down by the thankless task of trying to explain the newest sub-movements in underground hip-hop to white journalists. Usually, there were a couple of other assistant intern-type people around, maybe a travel agent or tour manager on the phone. One of the latter was later immortalized by Public Enemy. At home, I got a call from Tony Rome. The other room was Russell's office and frequent bedroom, and who knew what else. A phone sat on a desk. Russell would sometimes yell into it. There were these two weird and disgustingly soiled futon chairs. I found out later that Russell definitely spent many a night sleeping on these things. His actual apartment was in Lefrak City, a neighborhood in East Queens, and his roommate was Andre Harrell, a.k.a. the rapper Dr. Jekyll, and later the CEO of Motown Records. After a night spent downing screwdrivers at Manhattan clubs, why would Russell suffer 30 minutes of potholes on the BQE and LIE and a hefty cab fare when he could just crash a few blocks away at his office? Here was the domain of the biggest rap music manager on earth. But at the time, being the biggest could only get you a Sam Spade office with hallways smelling like Mr. Clean and a crappy chair futon thing. None of this bothered us in the least. First of all, who are we to be snobby about a manager's office? Second, no sooner had we walked into the office than we saw Curtis Blow trying to break dance while surrounded by the dudes from Full Force. Curtis Blow was established. He had gold records for Christmas Rappin' and The Breaks, two early rap records that we'd memorized beginning to end. The dude seemed way older than us. He had Jerry curls on his head and small gold chains around his neck. He was just a big fucking deal, okay? It's worth remembering that DJ Run himself was originally billed by Russell as the son of Curtis Blow. As for Full Force, if you don't remember them from their days as Lisa Lisa and Cult Jam's backing band and producers, you might remember them as the menacing, muscled-out villains in Kid and Play's House Party movies. They were an R&B group that spent long hours in the weight room and were no strangers to fringing, beating, and bedazzling the shit out of their wardrobe. They circled around Curtis Blow as he, somewhat lamely, no offense Curtis, tried to emulate real breakdancers. I'm not sure if he was actually spinning on his head or if that's just a version of the story that we told everyone, but let's choose to remember it that way. Whatever Curtis was trying to do, I remember Russell sitting behind his desk, observing the proceedings with clear bemusement. This was a typical scene at Russell's office. A steady stream of rappers, tour managers, music producers, club promoters, DJs, and miscellaneous small-time hustlers. It was a full-on circus, and Russell was a very fast-talking P.T. Barnum, selling all the time, alternating between a non-stop barrage of angry phone calls and genuine, supportive, funny conversations with artists. That first visit set the tempo for our interactions with Russell. He charmed us, yelled at some people on the phone, yelled something we couldn't decipher to Heidi in the front room, talked about how Run-DMC would be the first rap group on the cover of Rolling Stone and how we would follow behind them and become even bigger. It felt surreal to all of a sudden be part of Russell's nonstop sales pitch. It seemed so far out of reach, so beyond any of our wildest dreams, so many worlds apart from the downtown culture that we came from. But somehow, you walked out of there believing that Russell could pull it off. And he did. Decades later, after our relationship had gone through many ups and downs, we went to meet with Russell for the first time in years. His office was in New York's Garment District, just a few blocks north of that original Rush office. Def Jam and Fat Farm had made him untold millions of dollars. We walked in, and there was Russell, sitting behind that big walnut desk in a proper executive office that might as well have been decorated by Burt Pidell, business manager to the stars. I couldn't help but smile. The smell of Mr. Clean had long evaporated from the air.
On the Mic at the Fever by Michael Diamond, read by John C. Reilly. It started as a night like many others. The five of us, me, Adam, Rick, and Russell, at Danceteria, bouncing from floor to floor depending on which record was being played where. There was a time before we met Russell when he had dabbled in actually producing records. Now that we'd started hanging out, it was easy to see why producing hadn't really been for him. Records take patience and focus, the willingness to obsess over small details until they're just so. Rick had this quality, but Russell was always more interested in big plans and the big picture, already a mogul in the making, completely unable to sit still. On this night, his restlessness and multiple screwdrivers led to an idea. "We're going up to Disco Fever, tonight, now, and y'all are going to get on the mic." Okay, that suggestion probably seems insignificant today, 30-plus years and countless pop culture trend cycles later. So Russell wanted to go to another club, big fucking deal. But Disco Fever was not just another club. It was the epicenter of hip-hop, and the place where hip-hop began, the boogie-down Bronx. A ton of our heroes made their names and reputations there. Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, Busy Bee, Curtis Blow, the Treacherous Three, the Sugar Hill Gang. And everybody would hang out there. Musicians, drug dealers, drug users, b-boys, hip-hop fans. Things didn't get rolling there until 3 or 4 a.m. If your record didn't make it there, you weren't legit. The owner also had a label called The Fever that released 12 inches by Lovebug Starsky and others. Performing at Disco Fever was a trial by fire. It was OG before OG was an expression. So for Russell to suggest that we, three upstart white teenagers who were just figuring out how to rap, go there and get on stage was akin to making your high school's junior varsity basketball team and then having your coach say that you had to play the 1987-88 Los Angeles Lakers and win. That's the great thing about being a teenager, though. You think you're bulletproof. Stupidity and arrogance trump realism and fear. We love to rap, and we're quite honestly feeling ourselves as super minor league celebrities within the small world of downtown clubs. But this would be different. This was fucking Disco fucking Fever. We piled into the car, and off we went. We had this idea in our heads that there would be hundreds of people outside, all behind velvet ropes, desperate to get in. Nope. When we walked in, there was nobody outside at all. Inside, it was basically empty. More like a dressed-up corner bar than Studio 54. I mean, there were seriously maybe a dozen dudes up in that place. And the club reeked of something strange. We were only kids, but we knew what the smell was. Menthol cigarettes laced with cocaine. Cocoa Puffs. So we got inside, and of course Russell knew everybody. He had it wired. He introduced us to Sal Abattiello, the owner. Sal was also wearing something that the three of us already coveted, a yellow satin Disco Fever jacket. Russell would often show up at Danceteria wearing one, and we thought it was pretty much the coolest hip-hop status symbol you could have.
I would eventually inherit Russell's jacket, meaning that he let me borrow it and I, forgot to give it back.
Sal and Russell seemed like they had some top-secret funny business going on that we were definitely not privy to. It was a, "Fellas, please give us a minute," discussion, and they soon disappeared into a back office. Next thing we knew, we were handed microphones and found ourselves standing in front of the DJ booth, getting ready to MC. Now you have to understand, it's not like we were standing on a stage. We were sandwiched between the DJ booth and the bar. People were shuffling around, getting drinks, talking, smoking Cocoa Puffs, bumping into us. Not necessarily expecting anyone to perform, let alone three Joeys from downtown that nobody knew. The DJ queued up a record, some kind of instrumental, and we did a kind of freestyle using some rhymes that we'd already been working on. Remember, we didn't have anything out on Def Jam yet at that point. It was challenging for us to rap in any setting, much less this one. The whole thing lasted maybe 3 minutes. 3 minutes that felt like 30. Very sweaty palms for all of us. People hardly noticed, and they cared even less. I don't remember anyone cheering or yelling ho or dancing or acknowledging our performance in any way. In short, it was nothing like the kind of proto 8 Mile experience we'd showed up expecting or fearing. A couple of years later in the illustrious major motion picture Crush Groove, we performed the song She's On It in a fictionalized disco fever in front of a large fictionalized audience that was more like our imagined version of how this night was supposed to go. In reality, the closest it came was after we left. Driving back to Manhattan, we just all kind of looked at each other. Oh, shit. We got on the mic at the fever.
Running Them by Michael Diamond. Read by LL Cool J. Rick, Yauk, Horowitz, and I started running around together a lot. We had a routine. Meet up at Rick's dorm, listen to some records, go to Danceteria, hang, dance, scam drink tickets, talk to girls. It was as if going to the club was our job, and we worked. One night, instead of meeting us at Rick's dorm, Russell invited Rick and us down to Green Street Recording to visit Run DMC in the studio. For those unaware, not only did Russell manage Run DMC, but his brother is DJ Run, known to his mother as Joseph Simmons. This was real. This was serious. This was big time. I mean, we idolized Run DMC more than any other band, and when we walked into that studio, we were nervous, intimidated, and giddy with excitement. We weren't just meeting our idols for the first time. We were entering their inner circle and watching them record. In the control room, we found Russell asleep on a 3-seater black leather couch, a.k.a. the leather bad boy. This was a common place to find Russell at the time. This man was a screwdriver-fueled mogul on the hustle, bouncing from studios to a circuit of clubs to who knows what after those clubs, to having to wake up in the morning to go to meetings at record labels, which at that time were very straight and corporate. He had to catch a nap when he could, you know? Iconic producer Larry Smith sat at the board wide-eyed and freaking out with excitement over the record they were making, King of Rock. Like any artist who hears something in his or her own head that no one else is privy to, Larry could be reserved and introverted at times. But there was another side, too, where he would, like, seriously flip the fuck out, jumping up and yelling and smiling and saying things to no one at all. See, I told you! I told you! And we happened to walk in on one of those moments. Run and DMC were in the live room recording backup vocals. We just sat there watching, listening, and learning. The vocals they were recording were like delayed accent words to their own lead tracks. That thing where, you know, one guy raps most of the verse except one or two words, which all the MCs sing in unison. You know, White Castle fries only come in one size. This accented backup vocal thing was usually done by using an effect called digital delay on the lead vocal, which makes the one voice sound like several. It can also seem mechanized, you know, and a little too perfect when you do it digitally, though. And it had never occurred to us that you could create the effect live. But here were Run and DMC doing exactly that. And it made the song bigger, you know, more raw, more powerful, and just sort of more fucking human. In short, it sounded incredible. So we stole this trick and we used it on every one of our own records. One of 1,000 things we owe to them. In between vocal takes, they talk to us. Now, you'd be hard pressed to find 3 guys more different from each other personality-wise than Run, or Running Them, as their friends refer to the group. DJ Run Joe was totally frenetic. I mean, both his energy and his manner of speaking. It makes sense that he ended up becoming a minister because he had this very, like, charismatic, hyper energy going all the time. It sort of needed to get bottled a little bit and pointed at an audience, right? Now, meanwhile, Daryl, a.k.a. DMC, was the complete opposite. He was quiet and he seemed to live in his head like the kid in school who would draw comics in his notebook and walk around in his own reality. And in between these two extremes was Jam Master Jay. May he rest in peace. A steady, yeah, methodical guy, and unsurprisingly the backbone of the band, the architect of both the sound and aesthetic vision of the group. It was a huge privilege for us to actually hang out with them that night and over the next few years. Now, a lot of times meeting your idols can be disappointing or awkward. With Run DMC, it was the opposite. They were always super nice and generous, both personally and professionally. It might have helped that we weren't mining the same ground artistically. Attitude-wise, we were still punk rock kids, you know? We were always looking to fuck with people on some level. Run DMC wasn't. They were more interested in being the most distilled and absolutely best version of themselves. You know, we're gonna dress like we do in Hollis, Queens and make this really stripped-down raw music and be louder than any other hip-hop group you've heard before. It would take us a while to be completely ourselves in that same way. Again, back then, we were just punks. But they were, and will always be, rock stars.
Become What You Hate by Adam Horovitz. Imagine if you love ballet and had just given your first ever ballet recital. Think of just how bad and embarrassing that would be. But you did it. Technically, you are now a dancer, and thus a peer to Baryshnikov. Sort of, right? We had just recorded Rock Hard, our first rap song, and obviously we didn't think we were on par with the Treacherous Three, the Funky Four Plus One More, or the Furious Five, but we had just made a real rap song with Jay Burnett, the same engineer who recorded Soul Sonic Force's Planet Rock, and that is legitimately legit. We weren't recording in someone's apartment's loft bed, we weren't sneaking into a parent's friend's studio to record, this was the real deal. We were in a real recording studio with producers and engineers and editors and extra people around to run errands and a fridge with free sodas and black leather couches, leather bad boys, and everything.
These leather bad boy couches are ubiquitous in fancy recording studios. It's like some kind of professional dude code or something.
Rock Hard is a terrible song, but you gotta understand, we loved rap music and wanted to be rappers so bad. We wanted to be Run DMC so bad. We really liked it at the time, but listening to it now sounds like child actors trying desperately to make the words we are saying sound believable. First white B-boys we don't regret. There's nothing wrong with your TV set. Russell Simmons wrote that line and kept telling us that we had to say it because it was great and how B-boy it was and punk and all this other stuff. He also really wanted us to say, I can play the drums, I can play guitar, not just B-boys, we're real rock stars. And we went along with it. Okay, man, you're a legit dude in rap. You got fucking Curtis Blow popping and locking in your office and shit, so if you think saying that is gonna be fresh, fly, wild, and bold, okay, turn me up in the headphones. I'd love to blame Rick Rubin and Russell for the quality of this song, but it's us on the mic. We wrote and said the rest of the lyrics. We were the rap version of an 80s metal band with big hair and silk shirts, and there should be a link to this song in the dictionary under the word frontin'. Perhaps I'm being a little too harsh on this song. It's not that big of a deal. It's just a 12-inch record that sits in a crate of 100 or so other 12 inches. But it's this song that marks the time when things went haywire for us. This record is the seed that bore License to Ill and is an example to look to for my Become What You Hate theory. Let's Start a Band was what we were all saying in 1981. It gave us all something to do. Our circle of friends were girls and boys and no hassles. We loved and respected each other, and the hate we had was for the stereotypical behavior of sellout rock stars and frat house types. We thought it was so ridiculous, we made fun of it. Sloppy drunk dudes trying to creep on young women was repugnant to punks in 81. Unfortunately, when you're a straight guy in your late teens, early 20s, you can easily fall into the stereotype's own trappings. And we fell in, like from the high diving board. We got so caught up with making fun of that rock star persona that we became that persona, became what we hated. It got so bad that we kicked Kate out of the band because she didn't fit into our new, tough rapper guy identity. How fucked up is that? When Beastie Boys began, the majority of our group of friends were girls, like the coolest girls. It's really embarrassing to think that we let them down. Maybe Kate would have eventually just quit the band because we were starting to act like a bunch of fucking creeps. But it was just shitty the way it happened. And I'm sorry about that. Friends don't do shit like that. It took a long time to shake the tough guy party bro identity we had adopted. But looking back on it now, it was really exciting recording the song. We'd committed to the notion that we are now rappers. Rick made the track for Rock Hard. It was a loop of the intro of AC/DC's song Back in Black. It was a hard sell because punk rockers hate all that is metalish and burnout. We weren't allowed to like this. But it was like that thing when a little kid won't eat something delicious because they've never tried it before. Come on, just try a bite of mac and cheese. I know you're gonna like it. And so we tried it, and we liked it. And understood why Rick wanted to sample hard rock metal. It was like a weight had been lifted off us. And now we could openly enjoy those Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath records we secretly loved. Rock Hard may be a crummy song, but it was a good moment in the trajectory of rap. DJs and producers had started using funk and soul breaks, and even hard rock bands' beats, too. Billy Squier's The Big Beat is the go-to example. But no one was trying to rap over actual heavy metal guitar riffs, and Rick Rubin should for sure get the credit for that, adding yet another layer to the awesomeness that is rap music. Different genres of music combining and creating a new and interesting sound. Shaq and Kobe can do great things together. Unfortunately, Rock Hard couldn't compete. Years later, Mike talked to Malcolm Young from AC/DC on the phone to ask if we could clear the sample for a compilation record of ours. And Mr. Young said to Mike, "Look, mate, we've been in the game a long time, and so have you. Back in Black is one of our top three songs. We can't let you have it." But they were extremely generous and did not retroactively sue us for using their song on a rap record from the 80s that we should have been sued for by the listening audience as some sort of garbage-to-the-ears class-action lawsuit. Here's the lyrics to Rock Hard. "First white b-boys we don't regret. There's nothing wrong with your TV set. We're getting loose. We couldn't be harder. Our beats are bigger and better and louder. Got real rock shit, you must admit. Not fake, not false, nor counterfeit. I can play the drums. I can play guitar. Not just b-boys. We're real rock stars. When we board your ship, you better hit the deck. You'll walk the plank if you disrespect. If you front on the rock, best run and hide. If you got static, we'll take it outside. And you start to get dulled by the Beastie Boys. Use real rock beats, show up fake toys. Like claps of thunder from the cumulus clouds. Double R punk the beat and make it real loud. Then scratch it. Heavy metal tension running through your blood. Too much rock, step off the pud. Too much treble, mid-range and bass. The beat's so hard, it'll hit your face. You'll get crushed, hard rock, hard beats. Hardcore rhythms for fanatic freaks. Some people say this has been done. We're here, we're now, and the battle's won. Fists of fury in an MC bout. Rock so hard, it'll knock you out. The very first blow is the kick and the snare. The beat's so deaf that you better beware. When guitar and bass are in your face, the walls crumble down, destroying the place. The finishing touch is the vocals that slam, the final blow in the five-finger jam. Sometimes I write rhythms, sometimes I write rhymes. He writes his, and I write mine's. Rock and roll rhythms are raunchy and raucous. We're from Manhattan, you're from Secaucus. Mike D, Ad Rock, and MCA. Not before long, I can hear you say, in a way, these boys got juice. They're going off, you know, they love to get loose."
Puppet Show and Beastie Boys by Michael Diamond. This Is Spinal Tap is one of the funniest movies of all time. It's even funnier if you've been in a band. No matter what situation you find yourself in, at least one of the movie's details, the lying promo dude, the undersized Stonehenge, the cursed drummers, the never-ending backstage corridor labyrinth, will be directly applicable to a real band's experience. Case in point, our early 1985 show in Philadelphia, presented and sponsored by the pioneering hip-hop radio DJ, Lady B. To set the stage, we had just released our first 12-inch on Def Jam with the B-Boy Burgundy label, Rock Hard with the B-side, Beastie Groove. In hindsight, yeah, ouch. We hadn't really figured out how to make a good record yet. Our voices were all high in pitch because we were so young, but also because we were forcing our vocals. We weren't remotely relaxed or masterful at our craft yet, though I don't know that those things ever really happened. But at the time, it seemed pretty cool, We had a real rap 12-inch on a real rap label, and the record was going to record pools and DJs and mix shows and being promoted. All of which was great, except the record kind of tanked. It didn't seem to be getting played on the radio, and didn't even get played at the same downtown clubs that had played Cookie Puss 2 years earlier. So when Russell called us one day and told us that not only was Lady B playing our record, but she wanted us to come down to play a show in Philly she was promoting, we were stoked, and not only because nobody else was paying attention. Lady B was a truly pioneering and powerful woman. At that time, she was one of the only DJs with enough clout and listeners to break a rap record, turn it into a hit. If Lady B asked, we were there. The trip seemed like a big deal. Philly was an important hip-hop town, I'm thinking like right behind New York City at the time. With its large black population and proximity to New York City, Philly was where rap records first spread to. The support of an influential radio, DJ, programmer in Philly could mean a lot to us. Then, Rick, by now not only our DJ, but also the co-founder of our label, said that he couldn't make the show. This became, as you'll see, a recurring theme for the remainder of his time in the band. But whatever disappointment we felt was immediately gone when he told us who'd agreed to replace him. DJ Jazzy J. We are like, what? You can't do it, but Jazzy J can? The DJ, record handler, scratchmaster, a choice for Afrika Bambaataa? A member of the Universal Zulu Nation? Jay would be the most veteran, accomplished, and talented DJ we'd ever performed with, by a mile. Rick was a fine DJ, but at the end of the day, he was just a very talented hip-hop fan with the right equipment. Jay was a lifer. We couldn't have asked for a better accomplice to help us win over Lady B's crowd. We headed to Philly. The first sign of trouble was that the address wasn't even in Philly. It was across the river, in Jersey, Camden or Cherry Hill or someplace like that. We get there only to find that the gig was at a hotel, and not like some grand historic hotel, just a generic chain off the turnpike. The gig itself was in the ballroom. Again, we're not talking the Waldorf Astoria here, but the kind of small-town hotel ballroom that usually hosts local beauty pageants and puppet shows. No ornate details, just stained carpets and cottage cheese ceilings and the correct amount of legally required bright red fire extinguishers and exit signs. From our makeshift green room, we couldn't hear even a small rumbling of people in the ballroom. Still, we were hoping that things might jump off. Lady B showed up. She was very nice and professional, went out to introduce us, and we went on stage. Staring back at us as we launched into our first song, somewhere between 5 and 8 people, and those people had clearly won free tickets from the radio station, or otherwise been coerced into coming. They didn't care who we were, and they definitely didn't seem interested in our music. What was particularly ironic about the low turnout, anybody who was there witnessed a DJ masterclass from Jazzy J. He was incredible. We practiced with him a couple of times, and it was kind of unsettling how easy and effortless it all was for him. Same went for the show. He executed flawlessly. A consummate professional, which somehow made the whole thing weirder and more embarrassing. We show up with this veteran, iconic DJ, and there's 5 people there. I've always wondered if any of the audience members appreciated seeing him in action, or if they paid enough attention to us that they had a good story to tell friends a year or so later, after License to Ill became a big deal. But for the 3 of us, at least, the whole fiasco was worth it just to perform with Jay, even if everything else about the show turned it into one of our many Spinal Tap moments. It felt like a super awkward dress rehearsal that might never end.
This was Jay's only show with us. During this time, we had a Spinal Tap-ish run of DJs. Rick, Scott Jarvis, Roger Clayton, Jazzy J, Uncle Jam, DJ Thig, Sam Sever, Dr. Dre, Hurricane, and finally, Mixmaster Mike.
That's the other thing we had in common with the Tap. Things like disastrous shows or our first Def Jam record doing less well than a prank phone call set to music we'd recorded 2 years earlier didn't faze us in the least. Thinking back on it, I don't remember any of it making us freak out or doubt ourselves, which is kind of weird. You'd think it would have, just in terms of basic common sense. But I guess we didn't have much of that yet either. Soundtrack to the short film, She's On It, by Michael Diamond. We made another record after Rock Hard, our second record for Def Jam, She's On It, a guitar riff that Rick Rubin played over a stripped-down beat with us emceeing. Before it came out, Rick and Russell made a distribution and marketing deal with Columbia Records. That was a huge fucking deal to us. I mean, Columbia Records? Home to Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, Miles Davis, Men Without Hats? Big time shit, y'all. At the time, Columbia was based in this huge skyscraper in Midtown called Black Rock. We were used to labels that operated out of basement record stores or college dorm rooms. We were also used to making Xerox flyers and putting those up all over downtown New York City ourselves. Now our records were being distributed by a major label with product managers and A&R staff and promotion departments and assistants and Xerox machines and offices whose occupants left expensive cameras lying around that the King Ad Rock may or may not have been once accused of stealing. Which, by the way, he vehemently denies.
God damn it, Mike. Let's just not do this again, okay?
And when She's On It got released as our first 12-inch under the New Deal, not only were we getting major label distribution, we got to make a video. At the time, MTV was a big deal to any teen with cable, but they would only play like 8 videos all on microwave rotation. That was it. Huey Lewis in the News, Duran Duran, Night Ranger, Cyndi Lauper, the only two black artists played were maybe Michael Jackson and Prince. Oh, and Lionel Richie. Oh, and yeah, Tina Turner. We couldn't imagine ever getting played on MTV, but it didn't matter. We were so out of our minds psyched to be making a video at all. But we also had absolutely no idea what was involved in making a video. Rick Rubin was into film, and on many nights he'd stay up all night talking cinema with the guy downstairs at the front desk of his dorm, Rick Minnello, a.k.a. Mr. Rick. I guess we nicknamed Rick Minnello Mr. Rick to avoid confusion with Rick Rubin. Mr. Rick was a short, stocky, bearded New Yorker with a thick Brooklyn accent and a profound film obsession. Actually, forget obsession. He was a savant. Dude knew everything there was to know about all manner of obscure film genres. Noir, gore, silent, Hodorowsky. Never shy with an opinion, his attitude about film was the same as our attitude about finding music to sample. We were always looking for two great bars. He would be into something just because of a great scene or a few great lines. It didn't matter what it came from. An art film, a TV series, a studio epic, a forgotten relic of exploitation sleaze, whatever. It just needed to have that piece. So it was decided. Mr. Rick would direct our first ever video. Eventually, we got a budget. I don't know how much it was, but let's just say the finished video looks, cheap. I honestly couldn't tell you what the high-flung concept was. I think we were trying to make fun of a David Lee Roth-type video, like California Girls or Hot for Teacher, except on a crappy beach, on a crappy budget, near JFK Airport, with 3 fully dressed MCs. Basically, it was just us screwing around on a beach in decidedly non-beach attire, with a woman in a bikini nearby. The most mind-opening part of the trip was our sleepover at Rick Rubin's parents' house in Lido Beach, Long Island, the night before the shoot. Unlike us, Rick had grown up in a bona fide suburban home, staircase in the middle like the Brady Bunch. His dad had a real 1950s workaday look. His mom, Linda, looked kind of like a Divine Miss M-era Bette Midler. We showed up, and Linda was super excited to have her little Ricky back for the night. She never stopped offering us all manner of snacks, soup, matzo balls, you name it. Anything that a good Jewish mom could do, she did, embarrassing Rick the whole while.
Sweet 16 by Adam Horovitz, read by Tim Meadows. Beastie Boys were exploding on television. Channel U68 was playing our video, She's On It, every hour on the hour. Unfortunately, no one ever tuned into those weird UHF channels, and so no one knew about this tri-state area music video channel. One person, however, was watching U68 regularly, and that was the daughter of record executive Charles Koppelman. When you have some free time, Google Charles Koppelman. He's a fascinating example of someone who went from here to there to whoa, there? Made a ton of fucking money and did it with some random ass people. I say this because I just Googled him and discovered that at one point he teamed up with the dude who built LaFrac City, a neighborhood just off the BQE that I'm mildly obsessed with when I see it on the way to the airport. Not just because Russell Simmons lived there or because the basketball great Kenny Anderson grew up there. I'm just intrigued by it, okay? At the time, I had no idea who Charles Koppelman was. I just knew that some rich dude was paying us to play a song at his daughter's sweet 16 party. When you're me at 18 years old, you think every grown-up is a clown. I rarely factored in that I really knew nothing and maybe that square grown-up had seen and done some wildly crazy-ass shit. Now I try my best to take the advice a 5-year-old gave me in a park last year as he was about to run up a slide. Watch and learn. Anyways, Charles Koppelman had a daughter, and apparently she and her friends loved these Beastie Boys in their video. She was about to turn 16 and was going to have a big blowout party at the Koppelman residence in Rosslyn, Long Island, and wanted us to perform our smash hit song from that video on U68. A sweet 16 party? In Long Island? Oh, shit, yes. The other oh shit detail to this is, the headlining act for the musical performance part of the evening was none other than Run DMC. They were the biggest band in New York City at that moment, and what young Koppelman wants for her sweet 16 party, young Koppelman gets. We were so excited to go and check out an actual sweet 16 party. To the best of my knowledge, this sort of thing didn't happen back in New York City. And if it did, none of us had ever been to one. I mean, what goes on at a sweet 16 party? Safe to assume there's going to be a bunch of teenage girls there, right? Well, we were teenage boys and we wanted to mingle. A limo was sent to get us from Manhattan and drive us all the way out to where this party was at. For us, just leaving Manhattan in a car was a big deal road trip. We brought a bunch of friends and we were fucking psyched. We get to the Koppelman's and it's massive. At least it was to us. We get out of our comfortable limousine and one of the sweet 16 birthday party staff shows us where we can put our stuff and hang out before we go on. But we weren't brought into the actual house. We were kind of steered into this other house, like a small guest house detached from the huge house. As we looked around the guest house, we realized that the friendly staff member had locked us in. Mr. Koppelman must have heard about us or seen our video and was like, fuck these jerk-offs. They will not be mingling with my sweet 16. He did leave us refreshments, though, which was nice. In this weird, suburban, leather-chaired, dark wood, sky mall, lock-up mini version of an 80s Long Island mansion, there was one little window, and it looked out toward a swimming pool. After a few refreshments, our friend Doze, of Rocksteady crew fame, decides that he wants to go swimming, so of course, it being a sweet 16 party and all, he takes off his clothes, climbs up, and kind of shimmies out of the window, streaking and skinny dipping. It was wonderful. The record executive staff was not impressed or amused. Doze was locked back in the room within seconds. But he was brave and bold. He made an escape and saw the other side. Moments later, we were told that it was time for us to go on, to play our one song to the teenagers before Run DMC performed. We were a little drunk and a lot of ugly. We get out there on the backyard party platform slash stage under a tent and start to play our smash hit single. The crowd of soon-to-be almost young adults goes wild. Miraculously, by the second verse of the song, all of the power on stage goes dead. Lights still on, but the speakers are cut off. No sound. What's going on? We just assumed that it was technical difficulties, so we just stood around on the platform slash stage, mics in hand, tipsy and awkward. Enter a big tuxedoed security-ish guy from platform slash stage left. He took the mics from our hands and was like, "Thanks a lot, fellas. That'll be all. It's time to go now." The Koppelman staff quickly let us know that yes, in fact, it was time to get the fuck off the platform slash stage and go away. The record executive would rather cut his losses and give us a couple $100 than have to endure another moment of us, being us, in front of his daughter and her friends. Run DMC was a way better idea, and of course they were, way better. So we all got in the limo and fell asleep on the ride back to Manhattan. Our friend Dave Skilkin had a video camera and was going to tape the whole night. He got so drunk that he did the thing where you turn it off when you think you're turning it on, and then turn it on when you think you're turning it off. So the only footage from that entire night is an hour-long, close-up still shot of his dirty sneakers on a limousine floor, in the dark, with the sounds of an engine humming and dude snoring. It was pretty sweet.
A Room Paved with Asphalt by Adam Horovitz and Michael Diamond. Go to 59 Christie Street, Chinatown, New York City. Enter that building, walk past some trash cans in the hallway, and climb over some rats and up the stairs. On each floor you climb, there's a hallway running on either side of the stairs. Each room you see on those floors is a kind of sweatshop. Bunches of older ladies in tiny, grimy rooms sewing fabrics of some kind. Keep walking up. Get to the fourth floor, walk through a door, and enter a room. There's no walls in that room. It's just an empty, dilapidated space, except for a small kitchenette and a bathtub, right in the middle of the room. It's like the scene in a movie when the landlord opens a door and shows the goofy couple a dump of an apartment in a totally run-down tenement-style building on a grimy New York City street. This was Mike and Yauch's first apartment. As awful as this place was, hey, they had an apartment. They were kind of almost like grown-ups now. Remember when I said that there was a bathtub in the middle of the apartment? Not a bathroom, a bathtub? Well, there was. And this one thing happened at least a couple times. I'd be on the phone at my mom's talking to Yauch, and in the middle of the conversation, he'd be like, "Oh, man, come on." I'd say, "What?" And he'd tell me that Mike was taking a bath and while bathing would stand up to get a snack out of the fridge and kind of linger there, like fridge door open, nude snacking. Yes. Go ahead and picture this. A 19-year-old Mike D, fully nude, standing upright in a bathtub that's in the middle of a room. He's leaning over as far as he can to reach and open the refrigerator door. He gets it open, stands there for a minute, naked and thinking to himself. For whatever reason, I've always pictured Mike having a handful of Entenmann's mini chocolate chip cookies with one foot up on the side of the tub, then lying down and continuing his bathing process in a soapy and crumb-filled bath. Oh, and another thing you should know is that Mike used to be one of those people who would kind of talk at the same time he was eating, so add that to the picture. For some of you hearing this, this might be fantasy becomes reality, but my guess is that this visual has a niche audience.
Look, Adam, like you, I grew up with the relative New York City luxury of having the use of a separate bathroom, complete with a shower and a tub. But hey, Yauch and I moved on down. Definitely not like the Jeffersons. It was like we took a turn living in the New York City Tenement Museum. But to be honest, I got used to it. It was kind of great to be able to reach into the fridge from the tub and grab a juice. Remember, we had no shower. This was our only bathing mechanism aside from going back home to our parents or using a friend's shower, and we did plenty of both of those.
I was at 59 Christie Street almost every day, and sometimes I wish that I'd lived there with them because it seemed so fun and grown up to have an apartment. But, well, I was happy still living with my mom and, you know, the thing with Mike and the bathtub and the rats and all. I preferred to just hang out there. Yauch and Mike got a couple friends who knew basic construction stuff to build out two bedrooms, a couple of walls with curtains for doors. The rest of the place was a practice space. Yauch and Mike might always remember that place as a dump, a shitty apartment during that transitional phase from young adult to almost actual adult, the apartment that gets totally trashed and so you just kind of move on. But for me, when I think of that place, my mind goes right to the night of 4th of July, Yauch and Mike's rooftop party. New York City can be fucking magical in the summertime, especially when you're 19 and you're drunk and you're in a band. That night was a kind of transitional night for all of us. At least it felt that way to me. Us and our group of friends were all up there on that roof in Chinatown, drinking, laughing, and living life. In the moment. We were mini grown-ups, and that night we knew it.
Sometime in 1984 or 1985, Yauch was working at a studio called Shakedown, owned by producer Arthur Baker. Yauch was an assistant engineer or something, but mostly he ran around and grabbed coffee or picked up recording gear. One of the main engineers at Shakedown, Jay Burnett, lived at 59 Christie Street First. He had a great loft-type place. You could hear the rumble of trucks on the ancient Manhattan Bridge and see it looming high above. One day, Jay told Yauch that there was another empty loft-type space at the building. We went to see it, thinking it'd be as nice as his, and well, it wasn't. It was an absolute dump. The floor was literally blacktop, as in asphalt, not the shiny, clean, gleaming concrete of art galleries. It was exactly like the surface of a street. It wasn't possible to really clean it. If you walked around barefoot for 5 minutes, the soles of your feet would turn black. Yauch and I were like, we can play music whenever we want? Jay said, sure. We paused. We'll take it. Jay introduced us to our new landlords, Kwong and Eddie. They were basically like, this is the rent. If Jay says you guys are okay, then you're okay. Give us a check, and here's the lease. Back then, if you were willing to live in a room paved with asphalt and some guy could vouch for you, you were in. I have two distinct memories from right after we moved in. One time, Yauch's parents came by to check the place out. Yauch's dad was an architect, after all. Yauch's mom looked at what little there was in the way of a kitchen, then saw the bathtub in the middle of the room and said, oh, you could put wood over the bathtub for another work surface. For years afterwards, Yauch and I repeated that line like it was from Fletch or something. Later, my mom also came to check out the place. While I was showing her around, we discovered this huge dead rat on the windowsill by the toilet, which was in its own teeny closet. Fully rigor mortis, stiff as a board, my mom somehow remained totally calm and detached and was just like, oh, good luck with that, Michael. She had once been a social worker in the South Bronx. Turned out the place was fully rat-infested, not as in once in a while you would hear scratching inside the walls. Most people who live in New York City have experienced that uneasy sound. But at 59 Christie Street, we had full-on packs of rats, roaming the hallways like Stegman from Class of 1984. Every night, the sweatshops would put jumbo black trash bags, seemingly stuffed with food, out in the halls, and a late-night feeding frenzy would ensue. Our main concern with the rat issue was, yeah, the rats freaked us out, but they were a deal-breaker if we were going to try to bring girls back from the clubs. I mean, going into a sketchy Chinatown building at 3 a.m. was bad enough, but then walking up the stairs with rats flying out of black garbage bags? No way. When we mentioned the rat problem to the super, he suggested that if we killed a rat and left it for dead, and then did that a few times, the rest of the rats would vacate the premises. Huh? When he told us that, though, Yauch and I looked at each other and had this simultaneous light bulb go off. Rat hunting. We went out to Long Island somewhere and bought these pellet guns, some CO2 cartridges, and a gang of pellets. Then we hatched a plan. We'd stash the guns in our mailbox on the ground floor, possibly a federal crime. That night, when we came home from being out, 3 a.m. or so, we would grab our pellet guns, proceed up the stairs, and blast away at the vermin, Starsky and Hutch style. It was wintertime, so we'd have on down coats, plus hats, and gloves. We'd be good and protected from any stray ricocheting pellets. So late that night, we rolled in, a bit buzzed, we grabbed our loaded pistols, headed up the stairs, and started kicking the huge garbage bags. Sure enough, rats came streaming out of them. Somehow, we actually nailed a couple, then left them, dead in the hallway, for a few days. Turns out that particular urban legend is fucking true. Problem solved.
I would like to interject at this point to say two things. One, you guys are awful, murderous, animal-hating people. And two, I didn't know that the rat-hunting thing was your own idea. Nice one.
Now we are free to go about inviting girls back to our place or to play instruments at high volume or to bathe while snacking. There are a few other impediments to relaxed living at 59 Christie, though. For one, a giant steam press from the sweatshop above us would sometimes start going like, ka-choo, ka-choo, and literally bend the ceiling above my bed, like you'd see it go up and down by a few inches. At other times, there was something up there that would overflow or leak or whatnot, and all this burning hot, gross, rusty water would come through our ceiling straight onto my bed. There was no warning or schedule or method to it. Every now and then, it would just randomly rain down on me, and I'd be like, ah, what the fuck? When we got our first electric bill, it was something like $500. We turned white and weren't sure what we were going to do. Just then, the landlord sent the super down, saying he needed to speak to us. Now we were really freaking. We went up to his top floor office, which was actually warm and clean, unlike the rest of the building. Lots of marble tile. He asked us, "Have you gotten your electric bill yet?" We looked at each other. Yes. Good. You must have seen it was for a lot of money. Yes. That's because the business on the first floor uses your same power. Don't worry. I'll introduce you to Peter. He'll take care of it. A few minutes passed, and in walked Peter, a skinny man sporting short shorts and a Fu Manchu mustache. Peter looked at the bill and said, "No problem. Come with me." We followed him down to his ground floor business, which turned out to be a worn-down Chinatown brothel. Now we got the picture. We waited uncomfortably while women in lingerie walked by. He asked us if we wanted anything. Now we really got the picture. We were so freaked out and just wanted the money so we could pay our bill. He pulled out a big knot of $100 bills, the likes of which we had never seen before, and peeled off the bills. He paid our part of it, too, and told us to just come see him every month when we got our bill. Phew. In less than an hour, we went from maybe moving out without paying the bill to staying and getting all bills paid for us. Then there was the time that we were doing a band interview in the apartment and our toaster oven got shot. I don't mean shot as in ruined. I mean shot with a gun. A gun using real bullets and everything. We were talking to some music journalists. Suddenly, we heard this really loud sound, and the little glass window on the toaster shattered, and the toaster fucking exploded. We looked closer and saw that the hole was a bullet hole. What the fuck? We ran upstairs to where we thought the bullet had come from. In full MacGyver mode, we barged into the sweatshop above us, which should have been packed. It was the middle of the day. Instead, it was completely empty. One of life's unanswered mysteries. Things were just like that during the year or so we lived at 59 Christie. We had tons of band practices, and yes, Adam, that super epic July 4th party on the roof when a pre-Giuliani New York City got lit up. Literally. Chinatown and Little Italy were the epicenter for selling illegal fireworks, especially the eastern stretch of Canal Street, right near our apartment. M80s, blockbusters, Roman candles, mortars, bricks of firecrackers, you name it. The Canal Street operations were as fine-tuned and ritualized as any drug corner. You'd pull up in a car, a kid would approach, and in semi-discreet fashion, grab the appropriate knot of cash. He'd run back to his stash spot and return, arms filled with your order, and dutifully load it into the open trunk of your Buick Century or Ford LTD. This would go on every day and night for weeks leading up to the 4th. Once in a while, cops would cruise by, and the runners would have to cool it, and run inside a deli or act like nothing was happening. The best part of that system was by the time the day itself rolled around, all those illegal vendors would have tons of unsold fireworks left over. What were they going to do? Pay to put them in storage for another year? Oh, hell no. And we had the perfect rooftop view. They'd take the grated metal city trash cans you find on every corner and put them in the middle of the street. Load a bunch of cardboard and trash in each one, and light the shit on fire. This effectively stopped all the car traffic. Then they proceeded with the largest, most amazing, 100% unlicensed and illegal free fireworks show ever. They'd toss every unsold firework, en masse, into the burning trash cans. They'd line up mortars down the middle of the street and ignite them, sending them high into the sky. It was a beautiful and chaotic, drunken war zone, and we had the perfect perch. At some point, we left to go on tour. We gave the keys to friends so they could use the place to practice while we were gone. We came back, and the place was disgusting. Totally trashed. Looking back, I'm not sure if our friends actually trashed it, or if we had forgotten how bad it was from being on tour where we stayed in decent hotels. Regardless, it was time to move out and move on up.
Something Kind of Like a Virgin by Adam Horovitz, read by Ben Stiller. The story of how we ended up opening for Madonna is as follows. Since Russell Simmons was Run DMC's manager, he got a call one day from Freddie DeMann, Madonna's manager, asking if Run DMC would like to open for her on her first ever tour. Russell said, yes, but they get 20 grand a show. Madonna's manager said, thanks anyway. He called back later to ask if the Fat Boys were available for the tour. Russell said that they were busy at the time and couldn't do it. Russell did not manage the Fat Boys. But he said he had another rap group, Beastie Boys, that'd do it for 500 bucks a show. I have no idea why Freddie DeMann said yes, but he did. And the next thing you know, we were flying out to Seattle with Rick Rubin and Scott Jarvis to start the tour. Here's two things about Madonna in 1985. One, at that very moment when Freddie DeMann called, she wasn't the global superstar that everyone now knows. She was just a great singer-performer with an awesome debut album that people were talking about. But then her record, Like a Virgin, was released and started getting a lot of attention. Within the first week of that tour, she blew the fuck up. People went berserk for Madonna. Every other song from both her records became a hit. She was Beatlemania and Elvis combined. Every 12-year-old girl wanted to dress, look, and be like her. Two, we kind of came from a similar sort of scene that she came from. She performed at Danceteria a bunch of times, knew Howie Montag, Anita Sarko, Johnny Dinell, and all the early 80s downtown celebrities. So, to us, it wasn't that weird of a combo. We didn't know each other, but we ran in similar circles. Here's four things about us in 1985. One, as a band, we'd never stayed in a hotel before. The first hotel we stayed at on this tour was the Four Seasons in downtown Seattle, and that shit was fancy and really expensive. But fuck it, we're supposed to be staying here, right? This is what big bands do on big tours, right? We'd been playing gigs for a few years, but we'd never been on tour before. We didn't know what to do or what it was going to be like. We were something kind of like a virgin. Two, we basically did the entire tour in a rented Lincoln Continental. Three, we didn't really bring luggage on this tour, meaning I think we just wore the same clothes all summer. Four, Rick Rubin was our DJ. But after the first week, he had to fly back to New York for some reason, and he never came back. He told us that a doctor said he shouldn't fly because of an inner ear situation, but my belief is that he made up the story because he just didn't want to be on tour. Here's two things about Scott Jarvis. One, he was our friend from a couple years back and recorded the Pollywog Stew 7-inch. He came on tour with us as the roadie, mainly because he had a driver's license and could therefore drive the rented Lincoln Continental. Two, we needed someone to take over for the missing Rick Rubin. So, Scott was now the DJ. He was also not a DJ. At all. Zero DJing experience. It worked out fine, because all he had to do was start and stop two or three records on stage. We only had a couple rap songs. It's not like we played Egg Raid on Mojo for the Madonna audience. And so, that's all we did. Our two or three rap songs. Madonna's band were all hired gun session dudes. It was a weird and professional scene that we'd never seen before. The drummer, Jonathan Moffat, had toured with fucking Michael Jackson. This was some big-time shit. He had a huge gong as part of his drum kit. He did this thing like 40 times a show, where he'd hit these two big cymbals that were hanging behind him and catch them like frisbees with each hand as he hit them, sticks in his hands, never missing a beat. It was truly fascinating. We'd never known anyone in a band that didn't start in high school. This was super-duper professional stuff. Showbiz. This was the kind of shit that we made fun of, and now here we were. On the same massive stage with professional musicians, backup dancers, and Madonna. Before the tour, we talked about a game plan with Rick and Russell. What could we do that would make these people remember us? It certainly wasn't going to be our microphone mastery. Our big idea was that we should be as rude and awful as possible on stage. If we just went up there and played a couple of songs and said our thank yous and goodnights, like, who would care? Instead, we would be memorable. Memorable fucking jerks. The Madonna audience at that point consisted of mostly 8 to 12-year-old girls and their moms all dressed in Madonna clothes. Bangle bracelets, fishnet shirts, etc. By the way, I believe this look was created by our friend from the neighborhood, Simone Reyes. We literally made children cry. We were that obnoxious. I guess the crying children and angry parents weren't what management had in mind, so Freddie DeMann wanted us kicked off the tour. But Madonna wanted us to stay. I'm not sure why, but...